Hi everybody, it's Monday, December 16th, and Graham Fuller, former CIA operations officer, is here with us. Welcome, Graham.
Thank you, Nima, my pleasure.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, because I want our audience to know about you and what was your mission in CIA, and I know that you were involved in the Middle East. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, just very quickly. I was at Harvard University. I studied Russian and Turkish and some Arabic and Persian while I was there. Then it was during the Vietnam War. There was a draft. I was drafted into the military, and the military put me into intelligence that I didn't even know what intelligence was. And I ended up in CIA, and then I was sent to the Middle East for 3 years in Turkey, 2 years in Beirut to study more Arabic. I was in 3 years in Saudi Arabia. I was 2 years in Yemen. I was 3 years in Afghanistan and 4 years in Hong Kong. I'm very interested in foreign policy, foreign cultures, foreign languages. I've studied a lot of languages. I'm still very much caught up in what's happening in this crazy world, including the sad area of the Middle East.
Yeah. Let's get started with the Middle East and what's going on right now in Syria, which is a huge mess, it seems to me. How do you find the current phase of the conflict in Syria? Right now, we have HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which was recognized previously by the United States as a terrorist organization. Right now, it seems that the United States is trying to support them, to be connected with them. And Israel is bombing Syria, and the situation is a huge mess. What's your take on what has happened in Syria?
Well, first of all, it's important to note, I think, that the United States government has been trying to overthrow the Assad regime for probably 30 years. They detested the regime of Hafez al-Assad. They detested the just overthrown regime of Bashar al-Assad. The main reasons, I think, for U.S. Intense dislike and desire to overthrow the Assad family was because the Assads had all along been very much affiliated with the Soviet Union, with Third World Liberation Movements, with anti-Israeli movements, and the United States found that unacceptable and has been trying to overthrow it, as I say, for a long time without success. So at last, in one way or another, success has finally come from the American and Israeli perspective, and some others in the Middle East who have very mixed feelings about the Syrian, former Syrian regime.
In your opinion, what's happening right now in Syria would benefit Israel in a long run?
In the short run, Israel is triumphant. In the long run, I find it inconceivable to believe that an Islamist organization, whether you want to call it terrorist or not, but that has had some affiliation with Al-Qaeda in the past, I find it incredible to imagine that such a regime would have warm, close relations with Israel. I mean, cold relations, maybe. But warm relations, a change, I would find that very difficult to believe. And secondly, if Israel wants to get along with this new regime, I am not sure that the very next day to start bombing every single Syrian military installation in the country is the best way to begin. So I'm skeptical that there is going to be much close ties, but you never know. The Middle East is always filled with surprises.
We had two important countries in Syria, both helping each other and supporting Assad. Iran and Russia. Right now, it seems that those days are over for these two countries. Do you think that the way that they have decided not to fight with these HTS rebels or fighters, whatever we can call them, do you think they have decided it was based on a strategic move, or they have been defeated badly in Syria?
Well, politically, it's certainly a defeat for Russia and Iran, but not militarily, because both countries really pulled out. Iran and Russia pulled out, I think, based on what it seems to be quite good intelligence on their part, that the Syrian military was a weak and hollowed out kind of force, and that that the regime would not successfully be able to combat the new anti-Assad rebels. So therefore, they decided it would be wiser to pull out than to become involved in some long and ugly and bloody furthering of the civil war, which had already gone on for 13 years at least.
Today, we had a statement from Bashar al-Assad for the first time in the aftermath of this huge mess in Syria, and in which he mentioned two important factors in Syria. One of them was the economy of Syria, which wasn't in a good shape. It was a disaster. And the other part was the army. He said that he was in Syria until December 8th, right after the fall of Damascus, he has decided to leave Syria. In your opinion, what has happened in Syria was because when you look at the behavior of Iran and Russia and just leaving Syria and put it all the burden, if you assume that was a burden on their shoulders and put it on the shoulders of Turkey, which is more interested right now, it seems to me, and one of the countries that is more interested in the situation in Syria is Turkey, because of the Kurds, because of some Turkish nationalists are talking about Aleppo being part of Turkey. But overall picture, when you look at Syria right now, do you think that the situation in Syria was behind the decision on the part of Iran and Russia, or something beyond that?
There have been reports that both Iran and Russia had been warning the Assad regime for a long time that there were serious domestic problems, in different regional problems and others, that I think began to convince both of those countries that unless Assad could take dramatic steps to reform and change the situation, that his situation was nearly hopeless. Now, that suggests very good intelligence and analytic reporting on the part of both Russia and Iran, which wouldn't surprise me, because both of them had a significant presence and experience with the Assad regime. So I think they just figured that this was not going to be a winning situation, and that they would be far better off pulling out and wait for another day to develop some kind of new political, military, economic relations with Syria down the road, but not with the Assad regime.
Iran was in Syria because of Hezbollah. Hezbollah is important for Iran, and on the other hand, Hezbollah decided on October 8th, decided to join the conflict against Israel in favor of Gazans, in favor of Palestinians. Do you think, with what has happened in Syria, how the outcome of this changes that are happening right now before our eyes in Syria is going to influence the power of Hezbollah in Lebanon?
Sure, Sure, Nima, but that was clear when Israel successfully managed to decapitate major elements of Hezbollah itself, and that, not to mention its relatively successful assassinations, if you can use the word successful, against Hamas as well. So I think there were many indications that just that the game was up, if you will, in the near term anyway, for any successful maintenance of resistance against Israel. Nothing is forever. And I think, as I wrote in a recent op-ed for Chaz Freeman on Salon, I think it would be a big mistake for Washington or Tel Aviv to triumphantly pocket this win and assume that therefore history has come to an end and we now have a brand new Middle East. I think we certainly have a very different strategic picture in front of us today, but I would not. There are so many unknowns, including even the very nature of this new regime, that I would not want to bet on very much at this point. The idea that somehow, even with Israel's successful assassinations against Hamas and Hezbollah, the idea that somehow they had finished off the Palestinian problem, which I think many Israelis hope and believe that this may be the case, I think that would be a false and ignorant belief that this is really just chapter 5 or 6 or whatever you want to call it in a longstanding struggle. And I don't see the more triumphant that Israel is about having now won this round 4 or round 5 or whatever you want to call it, the more triumphant it is, I think the more hard line it is going to be, certainly against Palestinians, very, very unlikely to be major concessions to the Palestinians. A two-state solution seems to me to be long out of the question. Many years ago, I think it was out of the question. And now we begin to see with this present regime in Netanyahu's government in Tel Aviv that the hard line Israeli ideologues who are now want to press forward with an expanded Israel that, of course, we all know that God promised to Israel. So I do not see very much positive in this present situation. I think it is just going to delay a further and more serious confrontation. Furthermore, I mean, if there were any doubts on the part of, let's say, the government in Jordan, the government in Lebanon, in Turkey, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf, wherever, I think these increasingly bold and brazen, we might even say, geopolitical moves by Israel to take new territory is a very, very bad sign that I think will further convince the Arab neighbors of Israel that there is not much room for compromise. The only room is for absolute acceptance of a total Israeli domination in the region. And I don't see the region being willing to fully accept that. And I don't see any signs within the very ideological Israeli regime at this point to moderate its vision of a greater Israel that whose borders only God knows.
Yeah. You've mentioned the situation between Israel and Hezbollah and those decapitations, assassinations of Hezbollah leaders, which was a huge blow. It was so much influential for Hezbollah. And they have, if you remember, right after that, they have bombed southern Lebanon and they have said that they have destroyed most of their ammunitions, missiles, all of them. More than 70, if I'm not mistaken, the Israeli media reported that more than 70 to 80% of their ammunition were destroyed. Then they went to the southern Lebanon with the Gallant not agreeing. Firstly, he wasn't agreeing with Netanyahu and his decision. Then he has decided to go along with his with the Netanyahu's decision, and they went to southern Lebanon. And right before this conflict in Syria, we've learned that they went after some sort of temporary ceasefire. Do you think, what, in your opinion, was behind this ceasefire, temporary ceasefire? Was the way that they were planning something in Syria, or they've been defeated on the ground in southern Lebanon? That's why they have decided to go after some sort of ceasefire.
Nima, I think there are several factors at work, several of which you've already mentioned. But first of all, the reporting would seem to indicate that the Israeli campaign in southern Lebanon was not going well, that they had suffered many great losses. Secondly, I think that there was considerable pressure from Washington, probably, that this was simply getting out of hand and that Israel was creating greater and greater opposition, not only in the Arab world, but in the Muslim world and even beyond the Muslim world, as to the nature of seeming Israeli unlimited ambitions and even aggression against the region. And finally, I think that Netanyahu probably felt that maybe it would be good to have a little respite for the Israeli army to take the heat off Israel from the U.S. and from elsewhere in the world, and just view where the situation was going. Also, I have no idea what intelligence that Mossad had from Syria. But I would imagine that they must have had some decent intelligence, which would suggest that maybe the plans by Turkey and the Hizb Tahrir al-Sham movement, the HTS, was underway, and perhaps they should give this an opportunity because, in other words, this movement might solve Israel's problem in Syria itself. So there are many, many different calculations, but it's far from over, far from over.
When you look at Erdogan and the behavior of Turkey since the conflict in Gaza started, he went from just warning Syria, warning Israel, then he said that we're going to cut ties. He went after some sort of restrictions on the exports. Then all the ties have been cut. And when it came to the attack on southern Lebanon, he said, we're going to send the army to support Hezbollah. And right now, after the ceasefire, you see he's coming to Syria and attacking, helping, supporting these people, HTS in Syria, to overthrow the Assad regime. How can we understand the behavior of Turkey? Is Turkey on the part of the United States and Israel? Is Turkey against them? Is what Turkey is doing just in favor of Israel, in favor of Turkey itself? How can you understand, how can you interpret the behavior of Erdogan?
It's very complex. I would say that the foreign policy of Turkey under Erdogan, not just for 10 years, but even really going back at least 20 years, has been a massive geopolitical shift in what we understand Turkey to be. I mean, Turkey for years and years was the beloved American, ally, NATO ally, and the main pillar of Western and NATO power in the Eastern Mediterranean. That all began to change under Erdogan and under Erdogan's first foreign minister. So, in which a new vision of
Graham, can you hear me? I cannot hear you. We've lost your picture. And it seems that your mic is off. Now, your mic is working, but we cannot hear you. We cannot hear you, Graham, if you're able to hear us.
How about now?
Yeah, you're back. You're back. Okay, go ahead.
Good. Good. All right. Sorry. Anyway.
You were talking about Turkey and the behavior of Erdogan.
I was saying that there's been a massive shift in Turkey's thinking about itself, which is probably one of the most important developments in all of the Eastern Mediterranean and the Middle East, namely that Turkey began to reconsider its position as simply a member of NATO, and began to talk about itself as not just a Middle Eastern state, but as a Mediterranean power, as a Middle Eastern power, as an actor in the Arab world, as a Caucasian power in the Caucasus, as a power in Central Asia, and it was beginning to develop and still has serious ties with Africa. So it began to imagine itself as a world player, a small, modest, but serious world player. And I don't think that situation has changed at all. So Turkey is not the old Turkey, and Turkey is now the headache of NATO in many respects. You know, Turkey was willing to buy defensive missiles, air missiles against from Russia. NATO warned Russia against this, but the irony is that I think NATO needs Turkey more than Turkey needs NATO. Turkey is doing very well, thank you very much, and is not about to take orders from anybody in this situation. So here, I think Turkey is really acting in its own interests. It wants to have good relations, does have relatively good relations with Russia. It's improved its relations with the Arab world in many ways. It wants to have better relations with Iran. So I think it's a different kind of Turkey that cannot be put in any simple geopolitical box. I think Turkey has great ambitions, at least for huge areas of influence in Syria. I don't know whether they would actually want to take territory. I think that would be unwise on Turkey's part to do that. That would create fears of the restoration of some kind of Ottoman ambitions that the Arab world does not want to have. I think Turkey certainly will want a sphere of influence in northern Syria. And on top of that is, as you know so well, one of the major geopolitical concerns of Turkey is the Kurdish situation. I mean, objectively speaking, the Kurds are considered one of the very biggest ethnic groups in the world that does not have an independent state. That does not mean it should have an independent state or must have one, or that I'm advocating that, but it's simply a fact that it's one of the biggest ethnic groups with lacking an independent state. So Turkey naturally is deeply concerned about that, has been involved in intervening in Kurdish affairs, describing the PKK as a terrorist organization. And the PKK indeed has engaged in terrorism against the Turkish government across a wide area. So that is a major consideration as well. And the PKK has great influence in Syria as well. So I think Turkey is probably one of the most serious players of all, the most serious player in Syrian politics.
Do they really consider the situation in Gaza or let's put it this way, in the way that they're trying to draw their interest in that region, is the situation of Gazans, the people in the West Bank, or Palestinians, is part of that interest?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because not only has Turkey considered itself, as I mentioned, as a Mediterranean power, a European power, a Middle Eastern power, a power in the Arab world, etc., it's also considered itself an Islamic power. This has been a very, very important point for Erdogan, who has been essentially linked most of his life with the Ikhwan al-Muslimin, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a relatively moderate Islamist movement as things go, as Islamist movements go. And Erdogan has had good ties with the Muslim Brotherhood in many parts of the Arab world. I think he wants to maintain that. He wants to gain support and respect from Islamist movements everywhere, and especially from the Muslim Brotherhood, which it has ties with all the way down into areas like Somalia, into parts of Muslim Africa and elsewhere. So in this sense, I think Muslims, Arab Muslims in particular, would have mixed feelings about Turkish power in the area. They have respect for Turkey. They have great respect for Turkish power, for the importance of Turkey within the Middle Eastern region, geopolitically, economically, politically, even in terms of foreign policy thinking. But the Arabs will not welcome heavy-handed restoration of Turkish or Ottoman power, if you will, in the region. So Turkey, I think, will have to be quite careful in its dealings with, especially with Syria. If Turkey starts intervening seriously in Syria, and especially in relative to the Kurdish problem, I could imagine very quickly problems developing between the new Syrian Islamist government and the Turkish government, because the Islamist government will feel this is a violation of their sovereign territory. And I could see potentially serious problems there if Turkey does not handle itself carefully. I think Assad was willing to maybe overlook some of these Turkish policies, but in return for other things. But there is a problem there that faces needs to be dealt with.
We have two terms: Muslim world and Muslim countries. Or Arab world and Muslim countries. When we talk about Arab world, it's all about all the countries who are identifying themselves as Arabs. But in the Muslim world, we have Iran and Turkey joining this type of coalition, whatever we can call it, this combination. These two countries are, both of them are so important. Iran and Turkey. Right now, one of the main disagreements between these two countries was what's going on in Syria. And the way that Iranians, I know the Iranian culture, Iranian people, Iranian policy, I know how they respect Turkey. At the end of the day, they have some sort of competition with Turkey, but at the end of the day, they consider Turks as their brothers. And do you think that what has happened in Syria would bring Iran and Turkey closer, would separate them from each other, would make a huge gap between these two nations?
That's a very excellent question, Nima. First of all, I would definitely support your views. I would say that Turkey and Iran, and my apologies to Arab friends and other Muslim friends elsewhere, but I would have to say that Turkey and Iran are the only two major states in the Middle East today that matter in the world. For any number of complicated reasons, the Arab world seems to be paralyzed, unable to act. It's been stunningly silent on the whole question of Palestine. Both Turkey and non-Arab Turkey and non-Arab Iran have been far more outspoken in defending Palestinian rights and the Palestinian cause, and even trying to assist them in that cause in some way. So I think there will always be some degree of rivalry between the two, but you know very well, as given your own background, that Turkey and Iran have been deeply linked in, as friends, as enemies, as having mixed cultural relations for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I think there's much mutual admiration as well as mutual rivalry there. I would be amazed if there was any serious war between Turkey and Iran, but I can imagine frictions of one sort or another, depending. What we don't know is where the new regime in Syria is going. That, I think, could influence the situation. Will this new regime be very anti-Iranian as a result of Assad's pro-Iranian policies? I wouldn't want to guess at this point. There's so many variables in the situation. But my guess is that Turkey and Iran will continue to be friendly rivals, if you will, relatively friendly rivals, respectful rivalries. But I don't know. It depends on what happens very much in the region. If there is a really serious further continuation of Israeli expansionism and seizure of Arab lands, not to mention what will happen now in Jerusalem, I think it's very possible that you will find people like Ben-Gvir and other ideologues within the Zionist ideologues within the region to maybe undertake some kind of attack against Al-Aqsa Mosque as a quick way to really start a regional war in which Israel is by far overwhelmingly the most powerful military force there. So I think if there was, for example, an attack against Al-Aqsa Mosque, or God forbid, a destruction or a bomb or seizure, whatever, I could easily imagine an issue like that bringing Turkey and Iran very much together very quickly, not to mention other Arab or even other Muslim states in the world. I would not rule out an action like that, nor would I remotely rule out an action by Israel to essentially bomb nuclear facilities in Iran, partly designed to spark war that would bring the U.S. into the situation. That's very much been an Israeli goal, is to involve the U.S. in a war against Syria. I mean, against Iran. So I think a lot how Turkey and Iran get along with this whole situation depends a lot on what happens in the region. But I tend to think there will be maybe some friendly rivalry, but I doubt any true military conflict. But you never know.
Yeah. And the other part of this equation is what is happening right now in Ukraine. It seems to me if the United States was the mastermind of what has happened in Syria together with Turkey, it was not because of Israel, it was because of what's going on in Ukraine. Because we know that the Biden administration is so obsessed with what's happening right now in Ukraine. They wanted to overstretch the Russian army, make a new conflict. We had in Georgia, we had right in Syria. It seems that they have tried to distract Russia from what's going on in Ukraine. How do you see the role of the conflict in Ukraine and the way that the Biden administration tried to just continue that conflict to the Middle East. Is that the case for the Biden administration?
I think that really depends on who you talk to within the Biden administration. As you know, there are neocon forces. There are a lot of pro-Zionist forces within the Biden administration, who I think whose long range goal is really to bring down Russia above all else. There are others for whom that is an extreme, perhaps a little bit too extreme a goal. But I doubt that there is a pure direct connection between events in Ukraine and the events in Syria. But certainly in the eyes of some of the more ideologically oriented people within the Biden administration, I'm sure that that is a factor. So it's very difficult to know how broadly and how widely many of these pro-Israeli, pro-Zionist, and anti-Russian forces are coming together in on these Syrian and Ukrainian policies. But for sure, neoconservatives almost by definition are extremely pro-Israeli, if not pro-Zionist, and are very, by definition, also very anti-Russian. So it seems logical that there's some kind of mutual understanding there, but I couldn't, short of working in the White House, I can't say how consciously this would, how much of a conscious decision this was to pursue both of these anti-Syrian, anti-Russian policies in tandem.
The other factor in the conflict in the Middle East was these Houthis, Ansarullah in Yemen, which nobody have thought about them before. Yes. Saudi Arabia together with the United States were fighting them for years. And right now for the issue of Palestine, right now as we talk, right before we come to this live, we've learned that they have attacked Israel again. And how do you see the role of Houthis and the way that Israel, because so far the United States and United Kingdom couldn't defeat Houthis in the Red Sea. That's a huge issue for the United, for Israel, because they can, the United States couldn't do anything about it. And we know as long as they had, they're just bombing these ships and anything passing and going to Israel, that would be a huge problem for Israel. Together, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, obviously, the tactical defeat of Iran and of Iran in Syria will have impact on the Houthis, particularly since how they will get their arms becomes more complicated. Not impossible, because obviously you can bring arms in theory to Yemen through the Red Sea. But I think it will maybe slow down the Houthis to a considerable extent. But it's quite amazing. I mean, I lived 2 years in Yemen. I have great, it's a dirt poor country in every respect. And has suffered from Saudi bullying and pressure for most of the existence of Yemen. But I think anybody who lives in the Middle East, and including Saudis, know that the Yemenis are very formidable fighters and very gutsy and very brave. So I think even though I had lived in Yemen, I was initially surprised by their boldness in undertaking attacks on shipping in the Red Sea. I just don't know how the logistics will be affected for weapons to the Houthis, but it's bound to be somewhat affected. it may be that this will be a breathing, a respite, a period of breathing for all the players in the region to see now how the new Syrian, Iranian, U.S., Turkish issues will proceed. Of course, the Houthis, we all know, are Shiite, but they are a very different form of Shia. They belong to a different sect, which is good enough. I mean, it's not Iran's support for the Houthis is not simply because they're Shiite. As we know, the Iranians gave incredible support to Hamas, which is 100% Sunni and 100% Muslim Brotherhood. And that was fine with the Iranians. So it's not only that religious factor, but it is a factor. And I just wouldn't want to predict where that will go in the short term. I don't know whether Russia would be interested in that. I think not, because interfering with Red Sea shipping would create much anger against Russia. But again, the Middle East always has surprises. And also, I should just mention, Nima, you didn't ask directly on this, or maybe you were going to ask it, but I think the whole question of where Iraq will be in this situation, as we know, Iraq, courtesy of Washington, the unintended courtesy of Washington, the Shiites took over in Iran, being the emissary, in Iraq as being the largest element in the religious element in the country. We haven't heard from Iraq yet. There's been a silence on that. But I think that could be potentially very important. Iraqi Shiites have good relations with Iran. I don't know how Iraq will play in this game. As you know, Iraq is trying to expel American forces from Iraq. America has been dragging its feet in that regard. But we don't know what that will be. And Iraq, it has to be an extremely important Islamic force in the world, including very respected Ayatollahs, such as Sistani, who was the Ayatollah Sistani, who was there for years, and a very major moral voice, not a terrorist, but a moral voice in the role of Islam in Arab governance and Muslim and Islamic governance down the road. That's a real wild card that I wouldn't want to guess. But we have not heard from that important big state.
We have two branches of Islam, Sunni and Shia. And we had that rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia by China and Russia together. Do you think that what has happened between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and right after Saudi Arabia, UAE, all of these countries are now have some sort of relationship there between these countries, these Sunni countries and Iran? The most important factor was Saudi Arabia, which is right now, they have some sort, they're improving the relationship. But at the end of the day, when you look at all of these actors in that region, in the West Asia, in Middle East, do you think that Sunni and Shia, as long as this conflict in Gaza is going on in Palestine, would bring Sunni and Shia closer together? Or would the United States under Donald Trump would be able to make some sort of distance between these countries or among all of them?
Yeah, that's complicated. The history of the West in general, and Western imperialism, Western colonialism, has been to try to play off one Islamic faction against another. So even British involvement, going back to British colonialism in India, was to try to play off some large Shiite and Sunni elements within within India. So Washington itself has also been part of that game. Also, I should add that if Washington has a deep-seated anger against Iran that is almost irrational at this point. Most Americans and most American policymakers really loathe Iran and would be psychologically, I think, delighted to see anything that would. It's not just about the Ayatollahs. Yes, it's the Ayatollahs, but it's more than that. Americans remember that that American policy was humiliated by the overthrow of the Shah of Iran, and the fact that some 100 or so American diplomatic hostages were kept hostage in the American embassy for I forget 2 years or something after the collapse of the Shah of Iran. So there's a lot of bad blood there. And on top of that, I think Washington has wanted to stimulate fear against Iran among all the Arab states that they could in the region. I mean, you know, this is all divide and conquer and stimulate fear. It would stimulate fear of Russia, stimulate fear of Iran or whatever else. Once you get on the America's bad list, or let me be vulgar and call it America's shit list, which is what it has been for a very long time, it does not get over this very easily. So and it's very difficult for any state that's once gone onto America's bad list to get off the list. If you look at Venezuela, more to the point, look at Cuba, you know, which, you know, 50 years later, Cuba is still under terrible embargo and economic sanctions. So it is not a good idea to be on that list of American enemies. So I don't know where Washington will take this situation, but I suspect that they will try to continue to play off Sunni versus Shia. But I also think at this point that many Arabs have begun to learn that this is America's game to try to play this. Maybe the Iranians have gotten a little smarter too, and that the Iranians have maybe gotten a little credit for having supported strongly the Palestinian cause that many Arab leaders themselves have been unwilling or too scared to do. So I think there will always be some kind of tension between Sunnis and Shiites in the Muslim world. But it's also important to recognize this is not truly a religious or theological issue. I think the Western superficial analysis says, oh, well, Sunnis hate Shiites and Shiites hate Sunnis, and it's always been that way. Yes, there are certain tensions, but the reality is that Sunnis have been a powerful community within the Muslim world, and Shiites have been a powerful community with their own traditions and cultures and et cetera, et cetera. So this is really a communal dispute more than it is religious. The religious differences are not really significant within Islam, as far as most observers consider. So I wouldn't want to predict very much about. I suspect there will always be community frictions of one kind or another, and always some people willing to try to play off one side against the other. Washington, I think, is always happy to play off one side against the other. But it may be that Arabs and Persians are beginning to get smarter and decide that they have many things in common and not just supposedly traditional hatred of each other. I was quite astonished by the fact that the astonishing reconciliation that China was able to bring about between Saudi Arabia and Iran. In theory, you would argue that these are the two states absolutely at each other's throats, the heart of Sunni Islam and the heart of Shiite Islam. But both of these states recognized that there was not a lot of benefit in for them in this kind of increasing tensions that was playing into the American game. And they were, I think, Arabs and Muslims have been aware of that. It's just not in their interest to maintain traditional tensions if they can avoid it. And I think that goes not only for Arabs, but even for Shiites. And, you know, there are a lot of Shiites in Pakistan and even in Indonesia and elsewhere. So it's a big issue. And Muslims are not proud to be divided.
And the other factor, let's zoom out a little bit and see the bigger picture. It seems that the new government in the United States, Donald Trump and his administration, are really, because Donald Trump so far, he said he wants to put an end to the conflict in the Middle East and in Ukraine. It seems that they're going to be more focused on China and the situation with China. Do you think that we, under Donald Trump, he would be able to put an end to these two conflicts, or even having these two conflicts going on, he's gonna open a new front with China?
That's the question that everybody is asking. Obviously, we have a very different kind of American administration with Trump in power. And I think we all know that Trump is a very personally oriented, personality oriented individual. I think he likes, you can just look at his body language, he likes to shake hands and put his arm around people's shoulder. I mean, this is serious. He's a deal maker. He likes to interact with other human beings. I mean, I happen to have respected Trump greatly for his astonishing willingness to go off and talk with Kim Jong-un in North Korea three times, not once, not twice, but three times. I think he was hoping that through the power of personality that he could maybe bring about a change. Who knows? I mean, I think it was unlikely, but it was very bold and ambitious of him to try to do that. So I think Trump feels that he can, with force of energy and personality and a deal maker, perhaps bring about some kind of solution, particularly in Ukraine. Because, I mean, many of us consider this war in Ukraine was a war that never had to be, that it was the result of American foolish insistence on pushing NATO up to the very borders of Russia, as if you can imagine what the American reaction would be if China decided to build a military base in Mexico. It would last 5 minutes. So I think these are not quite comparable issues. It's very difficult, I think, for Trump to deal, for example, with the powerful Zionist influence in American foreign policy. I mean, when was it Marion Adelson, one of the biggest Zionist supporters in the world, in the U.S., gave him $100 million for his campaign. I don't know what he owes to her, but I think it's harder for him to squeeze Israel to certain ends, as opposed to not only not squeezing Russia, but to trying to work and cajole Russia to bring an end to a conflict that is in nobody's interest and even is causing serious damage in European politics. So I tend to view these as different issues, and perhaps the Middle East much more challenging. But I would not rule out the possibility of his doing something of interest. Much more in foreign policy area than I am positive about his role in American domestic politics, but we will see about that.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Graham, for being with us today. I would be happy to have you on again. Because I know that the way that you're talking about the Middle East, and you know a lot about those countries, Arab countries, Iran, Turkey, and even Russia. And I think in the future, our audience would be happy to have you on again and to talk with you.
I'd be happy to continue our discussion, Nima. You ask very excellent, probing, thoughtful questions, showing your own understanding of what lies beneath the surface on these issues. So anytime, yes. Good.
Thank you so much, Graham.
Thank
Great
you.
To later.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.